Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. One of the great pleasures of doing a literary show that comes from Los Angeles is that I've been able, more or less consistently, to speak to the Los Angeles-born writer Dennis Cooper. But he's been living in Paris for around the last 8 years, so these conversations are not as frequent as they once were. His new book is The Marbled Swarm. It's published as a paperback original by Harper Perennial. And, well, it's the first book that's not set in Los Angeles, isn't it?
Yeah. That's no Los Angeles at all.
It's a French novel.
It is indeed.
It's a French novel written in English.
With French characters.
With French characters, with French backgrounds, and a French sense of popular culture, and the names of French genes. Mm-hmm. I'd almost say it's completely new, but it seems as if it's been led to by your earlier work. Could you say how?
Yeah, no, I know. Because people keep saying it's a radical departure, and I guess it is. But, if you want to go way back, I mean, it's kind of a fulfillment of my teenage dreams of being, Rambeau or something. It's like trying to make this really charismatic, complicated language and be like, Mallarmé or Ashbery, for that matter. You know, kind of a visionary, you know. So in that sense, it goes way, way back. But you can see the traces. I was getting kind of tired of writing. I'd kind of pared my stuff down really plain and threadbare, which interested me. But I felt like it was just getting kind of easy, and I don't know. I didn't see where else to go, so I wanted to really unjam it. So I started doing that a little bit in the last section of my last novel, God Junior, I think. I think that's where I started realizing maybe my voice was a little more flexible than I had thought. And then I did some experiments that ended up in An Ugly Man, this piece called The Anal Retentive Lion Editor, and a couple others, just to construct this voice. But to me, it's very me. I mean, it's my voice. It's just really overly articulated and things. But to me, it feels like totally my voice.
Well, recently, there have been essays and people have started to talk about the return to or the need for a lush style. Mm. And, if people had been identifying your work with a kind of minimalist style, a pared-back style, that would seem to be the huge difference.
Yeah.
Except it's a lush style with a twist.
Yeah.
The narrator of the book, like your other narrators, you've said of them, most recently in your recent interview in Paris Review, that you choose narrators who have to tell the story but aren't particularly good at it, and that it's your way of taking on the influence of the great French film director Bresson, who would use non-actors in his movies, that your characters are non-characters, that they're no good at narration. This time, the character is very unusual. His father was immensely articulate. Mm. He was not himself gifted at language, and he attempts to make a lush, a lavish, a complex style, but it keeps falling apart as he speaks it. Let's hear about it. This is a section from The Marbled Swarm by my guest, Dennis Cooper.
I learned this quote-unquote exalted style of speaking from my father, who originally cooked it up after several early business trips around the Western world. He nicknamed it the Marbled Swarm, which I agree is a cumbrous mouthful, and its ostensible allure received a decent portion of the credit for accruing his, now my, billions. One night when I was 13 years old, he passed along the recipe, which I should have written down, but I'd just come home zonked on one too many hits of ecstasy, and he was tipsy from a course of Chardonnays, so he could barely have enunciated the instructions in any case. If you're curious, memory tells me that this voice was generated from a dollop of the haughty, triple-speak British royals employed to keep their hearts reclusive. Some of the tricked, incautious slang that dumbs down young Americans. A dollop of the stiff, tongue-twisting, jammed-up sentence structure and related terseness that comes with being German. Some quizzling, dogmatic Dutch retorts. And a few other international ingredients I didn't catch, which is the central problem with my scrappier version, all of which my father blended smoothly into his mellifluous French. The Marbled Swarm is spoken at a taxing pace in trains of sticky sentences that round up thoughts as broadly as a vacuum. Ideally, its tedium is counteracted by linguistic decorations with which the speaker can design the spiel to his requirements. The result, according to this mode's inventor, is that one's speech becomes an entity, as open-ended as the air it fills and yet as dangerous to travel as an unlit, cluttered room in which someone has hidden, say, a billion euros. My father used the Marbled Swarm to, well, I was going to say become a wealthy man, and that is true, but to say he ruined my life would be as accurate.
So the narrator is a 22-year-old billionaire, and it's kind of a novelty narrator in a sense, because it allows the young man, this billion euros, to pursue any kind of decadence he chooses. Because he is aristocratic, his decadence has gone beyond any that's appeared in your previous novels. He is a cannibal, but unlike most cannibals, he's not a savage. He's a gourmet and is part of a club, a cannibal club of cooks and gourmets who savor so that the hurt, disturbed, and ultimately murdered boys in your previous book don't end at the grave. They end on the table. You've wanted to do this for a very long time. What was your research into cannibalism like?
Oh, just the usual stuff, really. I mean, you know, I just looked at all the ones that were around and who, you know, from recent ones to, you know, the ones from the previous centuries. And there wasn't really so much, which is why I invented this guy, Carl Free, who was a theoretician about, he's in the book briefly. Because it wasn't really very interesting. Like, just, it's the same as when I used to research serial killers. I mean, they themselves are not, there's not what I had hoped there. So there was some of that, but then a lot of it I just you know, made up, or, you know, just used my own stuff.
Was it more or less cannibalism, the same kind of impulse that led you to be interested in piracy at a certain point?
Could well be. Hadn't thought of it. Could well be.
I remember that you had found a book about gay pirates.
Oh, yeah.
And you were surprised to learn that a lot of that tradition was homosexual, because pirates, after all, did live at sea, away from the company of women, and formed exclusively all-male populations.
Right. Well, that's like my fiction, of course.
Yeah, and also that it leads to that sense lurking underneath that there could be a mystery story or an adventure story, or in this case a haunted house story, that underlies the fiction and acts as its narrative draw.
Yeah. I mean, whether it came from that book, it's very interesting question, because I hadn't even thought about that book for years and years, but yes, the two definitely could only exist in a wedding situation, it seemed to me. You know, I was thinking more about Halloween haunted houses and things that I immediately like, or video games.
So this book has impulses toward great fun.
Yeah.
Haunted houses, secret passages. How did you describe this book, even to yourself? What were you writing?
That's so hard. The way I work is like, I have this idea that I want to write about something, and it's, for instance, in this case, it was cannibal. I wanted to write a book about cannibalism. That was the first thing. And then I wanted to do this thing with my voice to make it, like, you know, visionary and complicated or whatever. And then I was in Paris, so I thought I'd write about Paris. And then being in Paris, you know, has its own melancholy for me and its own interests and things. And, you know, so it kind of, it works that way. It's not like I have a... it's not like I have a really clear idea of why this book became what it is, because I just was interested in designing it, and I have the way I work usually is like the kind of real stuff in it, the content, the subject matter, the things that are personal to me, are, I don't think about that much. Yeah, I design a way for them to be seen. I design the stage for them to appear, and then I use that organizing principles to make sure that they're being accurately reflected. But I am, that kind of stuff is hard for me to articulate. So I mean, it was just, you know, it's just about an emotional state somehow for me.
I'm talking to Dennis Cooper about his new book, The Marbled Swarm. This narrator is constantly bewildered. He has enough money, but as he goes around, he meets other children who also perhaps have killed their brothers, who live in houses that aren't made of rooms but of hidden passages. And in fact, by the end of the book, a family, a home, is described as a place that conceals hidden passages. Is that what the family has become for your writing?
You know, as usual, these are things I never think about, but you could be right. I mean, I don't think about it that way. I don't think about the family. It's the characters and the settings and everything are completely, like, created out of the bubbling mulch of what I want to do, and I don't... they're all just there to serve a purpose, you know, some kind of purpose. So I never think about things like that until someone points out the particulars of the design, and then I realize, like, well, yeah, I guess I was using the family, because I didn't even think about being about incest. People were saying it's about incest, and I'm like, well, yeah, I guess. Uh-huh. Strange. I'm just thinking about the connections, and I'm so interested in the mechanisms, and I pay so much attention to the mechanisms that I sometimes don't even think about those things.
There is a section of the book where you reveal one of the mechanisms.
Yeah.
You say essentially that a haunted house is like a paragraph, and that the corridors are like sentences, and the characters are nouns, and the reader is being asked to get past the subject matter. Could you explain a little bit more?
Well, that's an explication of the way the book is working. I mean, because the narrator is like, you know, he speaks in the marbled swarm, and yet it's a very faulty version of the marbled swarm, and so he's not confident of it. And he keeps trying to explain, like, okay, I'm probably not doing this right, and you probably need a little help. So let me give you this idea. How about this idea? You know, what if you know you weren't actually in that you weren't actually in a chateau. You were actually in this paragraph. And what if this paragraph was? So that's just you know, he does that numerous times in the book. You know, he says. He says that look up from your book right now and just look at this wall that you always look at, and there's actually a secret hole. There's a pinhole there, and I'm watching you, and I've actually been writing this novel while you were reading it, and I've been basing the way the novel proceeds on what your facial expression was and your level of interest and stuff. You know, and so he does all kinds of things like that all through the book, and it's just a way to try to both explain, to get the reader thinking like they can figure out the novel, or that these are the clues, or this is the rule book of the novel, and yet, you know, of course the instructions won't help you figure it out at all.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Dennis Cooper, author most recently of The Marbled Swarm. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. connect with other book lovers, join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Dennis Cooper about his new book, The Marbled Swarm, a haunting novel that delves into a set of tunnels and caves and pathways that derive from the father-son relationship, ultimately. Now, I detect two fathers, at least, in this novel, and the first is outside the novel, the Marquis de Sade.
Oh.
How old were you when you first found the Marquis de Sade?
Okay. I thought you were talking about Pierre Clementi. you mean that father? I was 15, and I just happened upon it and read it, and it was like a big... it legitimized a lot of things that had always been haunting me, my dreams and fantasies and things, and which had been incredibly painful for me or difficult for me to maintain and not speak about because I couldn't. So, yes, reading the Marquis de Sade was like really helped me find what I wanted to write about or find this screwed up part of myself that would be this endless supply of fuel, it turns out, for my work, yeah.
Tell us about the other fathers in the book.
Oh, well, there is the father who invented the marbled swarm who is – I don't even know if he's technically the father, but he's the one who raised the boy. The narrator says that his real father was the actor and filmmaker Pierre Clementi, who isn't very well known over here, I guess, but is quite a big cult figure in France. And he was in Belle de Jour and some other films are quite famous, but he was also a brilliant director of extremely bizarre psychedelic visionary films. So that is the other father, and he has an enormous influence, and perhaps even a greater influence on him, on the boy than the father who taught him the marbled swarm. But I don't want to go into that too much because that's part of the book. But yeah, that's the other father, and then he has this brother whose mother is Isabella Gianni, the French actress.
And the book is not shy about revealing that yes, if there was an older brother who died named Claude, there may be other characters named Claude as well, and you're going to be consistently baffled.
Yeah.
One of the results in your books, and more in the later book, the more something is described, the less it can be imagined.
Yeah.
It's a thrilling way to use language to hide something rather than reveal it. And throughout the book, one of the excitements, it's as if this way of speaking that the narrator calls the marbled swarm is like a sleeve or a condom that you put over language so you are protected from what's being said.
That's fantastic. Thank you. That's what I'm trying to do.
And that, I'm very delighted. and that one of the things that happens to the reader is the sense that you're reading about events that are not taking place on the page, events that are being replaced constantly by the language of the book. And yet the quality of this ongoing deception, on the one hand, is what makes a novel enjoyable, but on the other hand, it's what makes the world unknowable.
Mm.
It's the kind of confusion we find in reality, that if you want to know the real, you have to embrace this confusion.
I've said this a lot, I guess I have said this a lot, but I mean, to me, I feel like confusion is the truth, and that's always been sort of at the base of my writing, although I think I've gotten closer to it and more aware of that is what I'm writing about as I've gotten older.
If you were to think, for instance, that Lost can lead you into deranged behavior,
right. It
can also lead you into poetry.
Right.
There are alternatives. If you think that the world is simple, Lust leads you to pornography.
Right.
If you think that the world is trying to reveal its essence but needs you, to find it. Then it leads you to vision and poetry. And it seems to me that these books are about, in a certain sense, taking their readers and saying, you're young enough not to fall victim to addiction and pornography. What if you fell into the addiction for the quest for truth?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's, I mean, I write about, I seem to always end up writing about, in a central way, about the moment of intense sexual contact and also violence, and the combination of the two, which to me are the most confusing things in the world, I suppose. Because love, even love, you know, eventually love becomes understandable and is, you know, based on certain dependencies and things and all that kind of stuff that you have. But with lust, it's so quick, it's so intense, it's so, you know, and I mean, you don't have any language while you're having sex. You cannot possibly express what you're saying without just, you know, you just want the person to know, like, you know, you think they're hot, and so you say the words that you know they will recognize from, usually from pornography, that they can get the message, because you don't have the time and you're not to construct language. That all really interests me. So in that sense, there's this great confusion in sex, and I suppose it's probably the same with violence as well, although you certainly get a lot less depictions of that have any sense of realism about them and that aren't just, like, you know, either deconstructed too much or you know, commodified too much or something like that. So
this doesn't happen very often in the American novel, that someone is looking for the language which will show you where language fails and has to. What has emptied language for you? Why is it so? Why does it need to be so hard?
God, I wish I knew the answer to that. I really don't know. I mean, I don't know. That's the confusion, you know? I don't really know. I mean, that's why I always talk about the mechanics of the prose, because I don't know. I just know that I have this intense sort of something there inside me that's really, really difficult, and that there's no other way out for it, because like as a person, I'm too interested in, like, engaging with people and being supportive and different. I have a social kind of way of in dealing with people in the world that I'm comfortable with, but it doesn't allow anything to come out, you know. You know, I always wanted to do a rewrite of that Heart is a Lonely Hunter, because I always related to that book. So somehow it's there, but I don't know what it is. I mean, perhaps it must. I don't know whether it has to do with sex and violence, or whether those are just like the fireworks in which, you know, which they manage to get out or something. I don't know. I honestly don't know what it is.
When I am trying to account for you as a critic, yeah, or an intellectual, I say to people, because people also will say to me, you love Dennis Cooper's work. Why? Mm. And I said, well, to begin with, Dennis taught me much of what I know about popular culture, or at least put me on a path of knowing something about it, because I was turning away from it. So I often find that your books are trying to find language for the feelings that pop culture gestures toward and stops short of, and that often what you get to are bands like the Jesus and Mary Chain, where it was you who said to me, you can't hear the words, they're buried in a thundering tide of music, and the creators of the song are trapped inside, trying to allow you to hear a message that their music will prevent you from hearing. And I thought, wow,
yeah.
What an intention.
Yeah. I love that kind of thing, obviously. If I did that for you, then you actually helped me get back to the novel after having basically given up on it when I was, you know, in the late 70s and early 80s, because of your enormous knowledge of fiction. And I had basically given up and thought I couldn't do what I wanted to do. So you helped me begin to find my way back into fiction, and that was really amazing. So,
well, no, thank you very much. I wanted to ask you, though, why do you think it is that pop knows these things? Why is it available there in the most accessible culture and not in the high culture?
I don't know. It's the speed of the production, but I don't know why that is. It's because it's spontaneous. It has a spontaneity and it isn't self-conscious. And there are people making pop who are intellectuals, that's for sure. But it's really also just that they're keyed into something, and there's some way in which their personal interests and stuff and their talent and what's going on around them just collide, and they can get it out and they don't have to think that much about it. You know, and I don't know why that is, but it's just the high speed of production. Music is always like completely far ahead of any other medium for me. It's always right, you know. So, but I have no idea why.
Well, could it also be that this is one of the very few places where kids are not told, oh, you'll understand this when you're a grown-up?
Well, that could easily be.
Yeah, that this is the time to make this music. You won't be able to make it when and if you happen to grow up. That being an adult will be a liability.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, because I've interviewed a lot of people who make really smart music, and it's amazing how often they simply can't see it the way I do. They don't, you know. So if Sonic Youth, you know, for instance, like an older band, I mean, they love Dodie Bellamy's books, for instance, but they can't talk about their own work that way. And it's the same with Stephen Malkmus and some of the smarter people. They'll go, yeah, like I do with you. Yeah, that's true. but they honestly don't think about their work that way. They'll go, yeah, it makes sense. Yeah, I like Ashbury. That's the only way I can explain it, as he said. They'll say, yeah, Ashbury's cool.
I've been talking with Dennis Cooper, author most recently of The Marbled Swarm. It's published in paperback by Harper Perennial. Thank you, Dennis, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Craig Erthine. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.